things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Here's who is an addict. Most of us do not have to think twice about this question. We know. Our whole life and thinking is centered in drugs in one form or another, the getting and using and finding ways and means to get more. We used to live and live to use. Very simply, an addict is a man or woman whose life is controlled by drugs. We are people in the grip of a continuing and progressive illness whose ends are always the same: jails, institutions, and death. That was the first thing I related with when I came into the program: jails, institutions. I'd like to introduce now the one to read how it works, Gene H. from Ashland, Oregon.
Hi, everybody. My name is Gene, and I'm a drug addict.
Hi, Gene.
I'm very happy to be here, and this convention means an awful lot to me. Some real good things have happened here, especially to me, in my communication and feelings towards certain people, and it has to do with the theme coming together. How it works. If you want what we have to offer and are willing to make the effort to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. These are suggested only, but they are the principles that made our recovery possible. One, we admitted that we were powerless over our addiction, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrong. Six, we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, we humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, we made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, we made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. We continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. We sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of those steps, we tried to carry this message to addicts and to practice these principles in all our affairs. This sounds like a big order, and we can't do it all at once. We didn't become addicted in one day, so remember, easy does it. There is one thing more than anything else that will defeat us in our recovery. This is an attitude of indifference or intolerance towards spiritual principles. Although there are no musts in NA, there are three things that seem indispensable. These are honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness to try. With these, we are well on our way. We feel that our approach to the problem of addiction is completely realistic, for the therapeutic value of one addict helping another is without parallel. We feel that our way is practical, for one addict can best understand and help another addict. We believe that the sooner we face our problems within our society in everyday living, just that much faster do we become acceptable, responsible, and productive members of that society. The only way to keep from getting or continuing a habit is not to take that first fix, pill, or drink. If you are like us, you know that one is too many and 1,000 never enough. We put great emphasis on this, for we know that when we use drugs in any form or substitute one for another, we release our addiction all over again or create a new one. The substitution of alcohol has caused a great many addicts to form a new addiction pattern, which in its progression brings as many problems as before. We seem to forget that alcohol is one of the oldest known drugs, It would appear that we are people with addictive personalities who are strongly susceptible to alcoholic addiction. Thank you.
So beautiful to see all these dopamines, you know, here. It really is. And I know a lot of these people, you know, all these people here, I went different places trying to get clean, and I finally ended up in Los Angeles getting clean. And I'm grateful for all the people that helped me through all the time. You know, all the people that told me it takes what it takes, you know, and all those things like that. But it's really good to be up here. I'm grateful to be able to lead this meeting. All the people that helped me to get clean and to listen to me and for me to listen to them. So it took all that for me to get to this space and time. Okay, and this lady right here that I'm going to introduce right now for the reading for the 12 traditions, she's a good woman. She's helped me a lot because she's shown me the insanity. You know, it can be crazy in the program, it's okay. I'd like to introduce Mary H. from San Jose.
Hi, I'm Mary. I'm an addict and alcoholic.
Hi, Mary.
These are the 12 traditions of NA. We keep what we have only with vigilance, and just as freedom for the individual comes from the 12 steps, so freedom for the group springs from our traditions. As long as the ties that bind us together are stronger than those that would tear us apart, all will be well. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on NA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are servants, are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop using. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or NA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry the message to the addict who still suffers. Six, an NA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the NA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, or prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every NA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Narcotics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, NA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. NA has no opinion on outside issues, hence the NA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. And I did it all without spitting, Jack.
Thank you, Mary. Keep coming back. Okay. It's overwhelming to be in this room with all those people and they're clean and sober. You know, even the ones that aren't clean and sober. Now I'd like to introduce the main speaker from Reading, Doesn't say in here. It doesn't say, but anyway, Pepe from Brady, California.
Good morning. My name is Pepe and I'm a drug addict. You know, this really has been an exciting weekend for me. I've been just full of, I've just been jacked up all weekend. I haven't been able to sleep. I guess I'm just excited, you know. This is a very important thing for me. About a month or so ago, I got a call from my friend Mike and told me that the committee had was asking me to be a speaker at this convention. And without hesitation, I accepted. And it's a privilege. It's an honor, I feel, to be asked to come up here and share some of the things that have happened to me since I've been a member of this fellowship. I told my son, Tony, that I was going to come up and speak, and he wanted to come with me. So I told my wife, Tony and I are going to go down and we'll call Gene, and the three of us will go down and spend a weekend down in Ventura. And I didn't think too much about it after that because I've been awfully busy. I live up in a little ranch up in Redding, and a couple of weeks ago I got a permit from the United States Forestry to go up into the woods and cut some tamarack. I've been building some corrals and some fences and trying to get things organized, you know, for the winter. I have a big steer that I got at the auction a couple of weeks ago, and we're trying to make a pen for him. And next month on the 10th, my 400-pound sow is going to have some little pups. And so we're trying to get everything, you know. So I've been awfully busy. I've been trying to put in a water line from the house up to the corral. And so I really haven't had time to think about coming out here and being a speaker. And finally, last Thursday, I realized that, you know, the time had come. You know, we're going to leave tomorrow morning, and I didn't know what I was going to wear. I told my wife, look at Mom, I'm going to go down to the feed store and try to get myself a pair of trousers. So I went down to the feed store, and I found a nice pair of pants to wear. I looked in the closet, and I found a nice shirt, and Tony got some clothes together, and we threw it in a bag. And that evening, Jean came down, and we had dinner there. I couldn't sleep all night. I tossed and turned and tossed and turned, and I was really excited, you know. And I was thinking, gee, who I'm going to see when I get there? I'll probably see people I haven't seen in many, many years. And my mind was going 100 miles an hour. And I finally fell asleep at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I got up at 5. And we finally made it into Ventura at 10 o'clock that night, or a little before 10 o'clock, and we got here when Danny was speaking. And, it was just beautiful, you know, coming into this big room and seeing so many people, and I've been really, really excited ever since. You know, and last night I tossed and turned, and I didn't get too much sleep. And when we were going home last night after the dance, Tony, my boy, was asking me, what are you going to talk about, Papa? I said, well, I don't know. You know, I'll probably talk about some of the things that have happened to me since I've been in this fellowship. And I'll talk about some of the things that I feel when I'm up here. You know, and I have a lot of feelings, a lot of strong feelings going through me right now. I think one of the most outstanding feelings I have is this. I don't know, there's something in this atmosphere, you know, right now. This feeling of there's a whole bunch of people getting well. It's a beautiful thing to look out and see a lot of people getting well. You know, and for those of us who have been sick and who have wanted to die for many, many years, we know what it is how beautiful it is to see a lot of people getting well. You know, I never in my life did I dream that things like this would happen to me when I first came along this program. I was introduced to this program in 1959, about the middle part of 1959. I was the only Chicano. And for a long time, I was the only Chicano in NA. And I met a guy couple of days after I was accepted into this program, I didn't feel like a member. I really didn't. I felt out of place. I felt very awkward. I felt very nervous. I was very lost. But I was a member, because I realize now that from the time that I came to NA, I was fully accepted as I was, just the way I was. And a couple of days after I was on the program, I met a guy who's here tonight. And I met him in a house on Lancashire Boulevard in North Hollywood. It was my sponsor's house. My sponsor's name is Scott. And I met Scott while I was in a hospital that year. I was taking a methadone habit. And at that time, they didn't know what methadone was. And I was strung out for about 19 months, and I had a pretty heavy habit. And I went to the general hospital because I was dying. And they didn't know what to do with me. And they gave me something for the pain, and they gave me something for the nausea, they gave me something for the headaches, they gave me something, you know, for the nerves, they gave me something for the muscle spasms, they gave me, and I almost died. See, they didn't know that, at that time, they didn't know that you bring somebody down from methadone with methadone. And this was, you know, many years ago, they didn't know. And during the time I was in the hospital, some guy came to visit me, and he was a big husky guy. He had a beautiful blue suit, a white shirt, and a wine tie, and he had a little limp to his walk. You know, and he came in. He was asking for me. I was there under a bogus name because I was running from I was a PAL, parolee at large, and he came in and he asked for me, and I thought, oh man, it's a fit. I had to find out where I'm at, and I'm going to get busted. And he sat down with me, and he talked to me, and he told me that he was an addict, and that he belonged to a fellowship called Narcotics Anonymous. He told me, have you ever heard of it? And I said, no, I never have. And for the 2 weeks that I was there, in the hospital, he shared with me. He used to come and visit me, three, maybe four times a week. He came and he shared with me his experience, his strength, and his hope. And he told me a little about this program. At first, I didn't believe he was a drug addict. But as he talked, I know he was. Because I know a drug addict when I talk to one. And then he told me that he was clean for 5 years. It was really, I couldn't believe it. I had never met a clean drug addict. You know, and I could never picture that someday I would lose the obsession to use. I couldn't see me ever not getting loaded. I couldn't see it. It was beyond my comprehension. And when I got out of the hospital, he took me to live with him. And that's where I met the guy that's here tonight. I was sitting in the corner and I was listening to all these guys talking about program, about the 12 steps, and about taking inventories, and I was completely confused. And I was sitting in the corner and I looked confused. And I was sitting in the corner and this guy came up to me and he says, my name is Jimmy Kent. And welcome to the fellowship, and we talked. I don't remember what we talked about, but I felt good. I felt really good with him. And from that time on, this life in this fellowship has been the most fantastic thing that I have ever experienced in my life. And believe me, I have experienced some fantastic things in my life. I think one of the most wonderful things that have ever happened to me is that without chemicals, I gained the desire to live. I remember once I got this feeling one time, wanted to live. I really wanted to live. And it happened when I was 12 years old. Before that, I wanted to die. I hated this world. This world was a very uncomfortable place to be. I think one of the reasons is because I was a very sick person, physically, psychologically, spiritually. I was very, very sick. I was born with a deformed neck. I have something that well, medical science has never run across anything like this before. You know, my problem in my neck is that when, you know, where the skull is, where the little hole in the skull, where the spine connects into the little skull, hole in the skull, and all the nerves and everything go into the nerve center. Well, in my case, where it's supposed to connect, it doesn't connect there. The three first vertebras are in that hole. This is why I have a very short neck. And as I grew, the spine grew, and it began to choke me. When I was 12 years old, I became completely paralyzed from my neck down. And they didn't know what to do. They had never seen anything like this. And I was real lucky. I was able to get in touch with a neurosurgeon. At that time, he was the greatest in the world. He was the greatest in the world. And he came to Los Angeles from New York, and he operated on me and he saved my life. His name was Dr. Peter Menstrom. He used to be married to an actress called Ingrid Bergman. And he came down and he operated on me and he saved my life. And I remember at that time I was completely paralyzed, and people had to feed me, and they had to bathe me, and they had to wipe me, and they had to do everything for me. And it was during this time when that desire to die was very strong. I didn't want to live in this world like this. I didn't want to be a burden to anybody. I had made a mess of my life ever since I was a little kid, and I didn't want to go on. And after the operation, I woke up and I was in a bed of ice. I was burning with fever, and my mother was there, and my dad was there, and his priest was there. And I woke up and my face was swollen, and I was in tremendous pain. And the nurse came in and she told me to move over, and she gave me a shot on my hip. I don't know whether it was morphine or Demerol, but it was something very, very strong. And that was my first taste of drugs. I began to feel that warm sensation. I began to feel flush, my face began to feel flush and warm. And the pain began to diminish, began to go away. And I began to feel relaxed and feel better physically. But something happened to me psychologically. You know, I looked at my mother and I told her, you know what, Mom? Don't cry, don't worry, because someday I'm going to get out of this bed and I'm going to walk just as good and just as straight as anybody else. And honest to God, I meant it from the bottom of my heart. And for the first time, as I can remember, I wanted to live. This is what drugs did to me. I wanted to live. It made this world not so bad after all. And from that time on, I had to kill myself in order to want to live. I was never able to stay on the streets long. I got busted as a little kid for drugs. That's all I've ever been in jail for. And during my time that I was using drugs, I spent about 12 years locked up in hospitals and institutions and finally the penitentiary. And I never thought that the day would ever come that I'd find peace until I came to the scholarship. You know what? I get choked up real easy. I cry real easy. So if I cry, please excuse me. For many years, I couldn't express myself. I really couldn't. I was locked inside and I couldn't express myself. And I finally get to the point where I boil and I explode. I was a very violent man. And I've learned how to release it. You know, I feel okay when I cry. I can laugh now. So if I shed some tears, please excuse me, okay? So anyway, you know, I came to this fellowship. I didn't make it the first time I came. I had to go back. I got busted again, and I went back. And this is what, during the time I went back, I really got into the program because I always remembered Scott, and I remembered Jimmy, and I remembered Sonny. I remembered Grant Withers, who killed himself. And all these other people who said, hey, come on, man, join us, and let's stay together, and let's try to find an answer. I thought about all these people the next 3 years that I was in Leavenworth, and when I got out of Leavenworth, I came out and I had heard that a brother of mine, who was a drug addict, was clean. And he had been clean for about a year. And I went to look for him. He was in a place in Santa Mother called Synanon. And I went to Synanon and I stayed with him there at Synanon. And the month that I was there was the most beautiful experience I had ever had. And there too I experienced acceptance and love and fellowship. And people accepted me as I was. But during the time I was there, I had always remembered about this program. And I told my brother one day, you know what, I'm going out, and I'm going to go see some people that I know. They belong to a fellowship called Narcotics Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous. And he says, you know what, Pepe, AA and that other thing, it's not for you, man. Synanon is for you. Stay here. You're not going to make it. You're going to go out there and you're going to die. I said, you know what, I don't agree with you. I'm going out there. I've got to learn how to make it out there on the streets. So I left Synanon, and I came to the program. And for 6 months, the thing that happened that I thought would never happen, I didn't drink or use for 6 months. I went through a lot of changes because I was never able to face life. I have been an escape artist all my life. Even long before I used drugs, I escaped in fantasy. And I escaped in many other ways. And I just couldn't handle it. I was introduced to myself when I first came around, you know, when I came to this program. I didn't know who I was. I had no idea who I was. And in the years that I've been around this program, I've come to understand and I've come to know me. This is one of the most beautiful things that have happened to me. I'm not lost anymore. You know, many times I'm alone, but I'm not lonely. And I've always, all my life, I was alone. I could be in a room with a million people, and I felt alone. I found God when I came here. You know, and it's kind of hard for me to talk about my God because it's a very personal thing. I think the best way I can express my God is my God is a product of my personal experiences. So it's kind of hard for me to talk about it. You know, I found my God here in the 12 steps. I found my God here in the spiritual principles of this program. I found six basic spiritual principles in this program. And there may be more, I don't know. But as far as I can understand, there are six. Six basic spiritual principles that are contained within the 12 steps. Let me tell you what they are as far as I'm concerned and how I try to apply them to my life. The first one is the principle of humility. And to me, humility means to become willing to accept the truth. You know, I think it took what it took for me to beat my head against the wall for so many years, but for me to finally get to the point where I was willing to listen. You know, for a long time, I was a cocky little guy when I was youngster. I thought I could handle it. I thought I could run things. You know, and I never would go to somebody and say, you know, help me. And I finally got to the point where when I came around, I realized that my best ideas, my best wisdom, my best everything I had going for me almost killed me. That's how much I knew. I realized I didn't know anything. And if I relied on what I knew, I would eventually kill myself. And that's how I came in. I came in with the willingness to listen, the willingness to learn. You know, and I'm glad I came like this. The second principle is the principle of honesty. The ability to evaluate and accept conditions as they are. And in my case, I'm a drug addict and I'm an alcoholic, and I'll be this until the day I die, and that's a fact. But for many, many years, it was hard for me to accept that. I knew I had trouble with alcohol, I knew I had trouble with drugs, but was I really an alcoholic? I think this is why I had trouble after I was around the program for 6 months. You know, I knew I was a drug addict, but I didn't know whether I was an alcoholic or not. I went to a party one time, it was my brother's birthday, and I saw everybody drinking, and I thought, well, I'll have a couple of beers, maybe three, and that's about it. I'll enjoy myself, and I'll get back to my program. And then the next thing I remember, I was drunk. I'd been drunk for 4 days, on beer, just on beer. And the fourth day I woke up and I was awfully sick. I hadn't eaten anything all during that time. I was just drinking, and I thought, I'll take a lunch break, get me over this terrible hangover, and I'll be all right. And I took that little fix and I ran crazy for 4 months. And I came back to this program. The way I came back to this program is I got strung out after the 6 months, and I had about a four or five month run, and I went back to Synanon. I went back to KIC. And I stayed at Synanon for about another 30 days. And I left Synanon on Christmas Day of 1962. And that's a day I will never forget. I left Synanon and I was bald-headed, and the clothes that I had were all I had. That was my whole life. I didn't have a place to go live. My family, they didn't want me. So I walked down Olympic Boulevard a couple of blocks, and there was a kid selling papers, and I asked him if he would loan me a dime to make a collect call to L.A., and I would give him back his dime. And I called my mother's house, because I knew that on Christmas Day, everybody went to see Mama. All my brothers and my sisters and their kids, and I come from a large family, very large family. I have 8 sisters and 6 brothers. And when they get together, man, they have a ball. You know? So I called Mama's house, and my brother-in-law, he got the phone. His name was Art. And I told him, Marty, is my dad there or one of my brothers? I'm in Santa Monica. I just got out of Synanon, and I'm stranded. I need a ride back to L.A. And he had a few drinks, and he was feeling good. He told me, you know what, Pepe, I'm going to tell you something that the family has been wanting to tell you for a long time, but they haven't had the balls to tell you. I said, what's the matter, Artie? I said, well, I'll tell you, man. You know, you've been a pain in the ass of this family for 20 years now. Because you make your mother sick, you make your father sick, you made your brothers and sisters, you've stolen from us, you've cheated, and you've lied to us, and you have put us through a lot of hell. So why don't you do us a good favor and don't come around here? And he hung up on us. And and it shook me up. I stood in the phone booth and I cried. Then I got mad, you know, I said, I'm not going on. I said, no, I can't do that. I've learned a little something since I've been on the program, and I realized that what he says is true. The best thing I can do for these people is to leave them alone. So I started hitchhiking, and I made it to L.A., and I was standing on the corner of, it's either 8th or 9th, and Spring Street, or Spring and Los Angeles Street. I was standing on the corner there, wondering where I was going to go. I didn't want to go back to East L.A., because I knew if I did, I'd use it again. And I ran into a guy who used to be a runner of mine many years ago when I was crazy and running and dealing in East L.A. He was a runner of mine, and he looked good. He was with his old lady, and he was all dressed up. It was Christmas morning. They were downtown, and he saw me. I looked bad. And he gave me $10. He says, Pepe, I hope this will help you. I don't have much more to give you. I says, hey, that'll take care of business. So I thought, well, I'm not going to be on the street tonight. And I was trying to figure out where I was going to go. And I thought, well, the first bus that comes by, as long as it's not going to East L.A., I'm going to take it. And the first bus that came by said Glendale. And I jumped on the bus and I went to Glendale. And that Christmas I had coffee and donuts at the Alliance Club on Broadway. And in Glendale. And this is what I needed. I needed that meeting. I needed those people to help me get my mind together. And the next morning, I knew inside it was all over. It was all over. I knew what I had to do. I knew that in order to grow and to succeed in this program, I was going to have to work my ass off. And I remember the things that my sponsor used to tell me. And he told me this a long, long time ago. He says, this is a do-it-yourself, save-your-own-ass program. He says, whatever you put into it, this is what you will get in return. If you don't put anything into it, you shouldn't expect anything. And I remember that. I left that little hotel where I was that night, and I walked down the residential district, and I started knocking on doors. And I used to tell the people that I'm looking for work. I'll cut your lawn for a buck and a half. I'll trim your hedges. I'll sweep your sidewalk. And when I was about halfway down the place, this woman wanted me to cut the lawn and sweep around and clean some wood in the back. And I felt real good. And I started working, you know, and about 20 minutes later, she called me to the back. And she had this beautiful patio, and she had this wrought iron patio furniture with glass on top. And she had a big plate there, and she had some eggs, and she had some coffee. And I still remember she had some orange marmalade and toast. And I sat there, and I had breakfast. And it was just too much. And after I ate, I cleaned that woman's yard. It had never been cleaned. And from that day on, I have paid for my way in this world. You know, I have worked in many, many jobs. I didn't know anything. I had no trade. I had never held a legitimate job until I came to this program. I had never worked. I was a professional. I used to call myself a hustler, but I was a professional leech. And the people that I couldn't leech off of, I stole from them. But today I'm not a leech. From that day on, I became an ex-leech. You know, I worked as a dishwasher, I worked as a gardener, I worked as a painter. That year, I had over 50 different jobs. I couldn't stay too long on a job. I didn't have the discipline. I didn't have a lot of what it takes to get up every morning and hit that job every day. You know, I had trouble with people. I couldn't get along with those bosses, and I couldn't get along with fellow workers. And I would change jobs. But I go right back. I get another job. And I knew I had to learn. Because if I gave up, I'd never make it. I knew that. And I had to go back. I had a strong desire to live. I wanted to get involved with life. I didn't want to die anymore. I almost died when I was in the hospital the last time. And I didn't want to die. I wanted to live. And this is what I did. And I moved to a little place in Eagle Rock, and I met this girl there at an AA meeting, and we started going together. And during that time, I was living by myself in a little hotel, and I'd go to meetings and go back to the hotel. Go to work, go to meetings, and go back to the hotel. And that was my life, you know. And then I met this girl, and I started going to the show, and we started going to the zoo, and we went. I went to the Arboretum with her. That was the first time I had ever been to the Arboretum in Baldwin Park, and they had all kinds of plants, and it was beautiful, you know. And I began to do some of the things that I always wanted to do. You know, I used to dream about maybe someday, you know, when I was running the streets, about someday going to a baseball game. You know that I never went to a baseball game until I got on the program? I never gone camping or fishing until I got on the program. The only camping I ever did was a prison camp. And I used to think about these things, you know. Someday I'll go to a concert. You know, ever since I was a little kid, I loved classical music. I studied classical music. I studied Sophocles. I studied Beethoven. I studied Rachmaninoff. I loved classical music. And I never had been to a concert. And I thought, someday I would like to go to a ballet and listen to Tchaikovsky. But this was all a dream. I had all kinds of dreams. I'm real happy because I have my son here with me. And this is one of the dreams I always had, that someday we'll get married and I'd meet that girl and I'd have some kids and I'd have a little home someplace and I wouldn't be using and I'd have some peace within me. This was my dream for many, many years when I was in prison and I was locked up. You know, I used to sit up in a cell and I used to dream about these things. Then the next morning I wake up and it was just a dream. I thought about that this morning. That's not a dream anymore. I've got that little home and I've got my son. Believe me, he's a hell of an inspiration to me. He helps me when I'm really down sometimes. And I've had some real, we've experienced a lot of things in this program. You know, tomorrow is a really exciting day in my family. We're going to celebrate my wife's 14th birthday on the program tomorrow. Together. We went to a meeting every night together for the first year, my wife and I. 1 year solid. Some weeks we went to 8 or 9 meetings that week. I never missed a meeting. Our whole life was this program. And beautiful things happened. I remember my birthday falls on a December. You know, and it's December the 6th. And on December the 2nd, the first year that I was sober, my son was born. He was sort of like my birthday gift. And I can remember coming from the hospital and going to that little meeting where we used to go and to tell everybody that I was a father. And I was excited. I was happy. You know, I was just thrilled to death. Something I thought would never happen to me. And we've had some bad times too. I have another boy who is 7 years old now. And the first year that he was born, he was very, very sick. We almost lost him several times that year. He had pneumonia about 3 or 4 times that year. And he went into the hospital and they wanted to give him a complete physical. And they asked that my other boy go into the hospital too. Because they noticed that he had large calves, his legs were real big, and he had trouble walking. So he went into the hospital and they gave him a biopsy, and the doctor came and told us that my two sons had muscular dystrophy. I didn't think too much about it, you know. And my wife and I, we talked about it and said, well, we'll get them to the clinic and they'll give them whatever medicine they need and they'll get better. And she said, well, we'll do what we can. We'll try to find out as much as we can about it and we'll do what we can. So she wrote to the Muscular Dystrophy Association in New York for some literature, some information about the disease of MD, muscular dystrophy. And they sent her a great big pamphlet. And we found out that there are several different varieties of muscular dystrophy. My sons have the variety that is called the Duchenne variety. We can. We're trying to find out as much as we can about it, and we'll do what we can. So she wrote to the Muscular Dystrophy Association in New York for some literature, some information about the disease of MD, muscular dystrophy. And they sent her a great pamphlet. And we found out that there are several different varieties of muscular dystrophy. My sons have the variety that is called the Duchenne variety. And she was going to read up on it and see what she can do and maybe put them on a diet, whatever they needed. I went to work that day, and when I came home, she was in pieces, you know. And I couldn't understand what was wrong, you know. I thought, what's the matter, huh? And she said, no. And I sat down and I read it. And I found out that there's nothing we can do. And it stayed. And man, if it wasn't for this program, I would have gone to pieces. I know I could have. And I needed this program at that time more than I needed anything. But you know what, man? Hey, we've gotten through this. And we're going to make it. There is no doubt in my mind that we're going to make it. We're going to make it. And like last night, you know, he had a beautiful time. He danced last night. Nobody said that you have to get up on your feet to dance. Dance in his chair. So he had a beautiful time. You know that he goes to every dance at school? And I said to him, you know, a lot of people say, where does he get this beautiful thing? Where does he get it from? And I know where he got it from. He has grown up in this fellowship. It has not only benefited me, it has benefited my whole family. I'm running short on time. I have a lot of things to say. I don't have the time. Before I sit down, I'm going to share with you something that has helped me many, many times when I have been down. It's a poem that I wrote when I was locked up in prison one time. When I was down and I was feeling bad. I wrote this poem and I have said it to myself thousands of times after that when I feel down. And I meant to share it with you today. And it goes like this. I knelt to pray when day was done and said, oh Lord, bless everyone. Lift from me sudden heart the pain and let the sick be well again. But when I awoke another day, I carelessly went on my way. The whole day long I did not try to wipe a tear from any eye. I did not even go to see the sick man just next door to me. And yet again, when day was done, I said, oh Lord, bless everyone. But as I prayed, unto my ear, there came a voice that whispered clear, pause, you hypocrite. Whom have you tried to bless today? For God's richest blessings always go by hands who serve him here below. And then I hid my face and I cried, forgive me, God, for I have lied. Let me but see another day. Just one day, and I will live the way I pray. And this is what I have found in this program. I found a way. You know, I have found a way to express some of the wonderful things that I have prayed about. When I'm low and when I'm down. Thank you very much, and God bless all of us.